Welcome to China Money Podcast. I'm Nina Xiang in Beijing. Today's podcast will talk about China's August inflation numbers. Is it reaching a turning point? And how will China's monetary policy look like for the second half of the year? Can China avoid a middle-income trap? And lastly, what chips are on China's table if the global economy falls back into a recession? Our guest today is Mark Williams, Chief China Economist at Capital Economics, a UK-based independent macroeconomic consultancy. Mark previously worked at the UK Treasury, responsible for economic analysis of Asia, and he's talking to me on the phone today from London. Hi, Mark. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Nina. Thanks for having me on.
It's going to be the Full Moon Festival next Monday. Are you celebrating, Mark?
I may take a peek at the full moon, but unfortunately it's a work day for me, so that's probably as far as it will go.
For those of you who are not familiar with Mark's firm, Capital Economics, the firm provides research on dozens, maybe like 40 or 50 countries, including far-flung places like Sri Lanka and Slovenia, and many other countries I'm sure I can't find on a map. So your firm has a very unique model. Not a lot of institutions offer research on such a comprehensive scale on macroeconomic issues.
That's right. I mean, our particular selling point is that we are independent. Obviously, a lot of the big investment banks produce research as well, but this is all we do. We are simply research providers, so we stand and fall by the quality of our analysis.
Investors can be assured that your research are not biased, you're not incentivized to sell investment banking services. Okay. So you can go to their website at www.capitaleconomics.com to check it out. So Mark, let's first look at the inflation numbers. 6.2% for August, roughly in line with consensus. What's your take on the number?
Yeah, well, as you're saying, not a surprise. It had been widely predicted, but still, I think, pretty welcome news because the trend over the past 6 or 12 months has not been particularly good. You know, we've seen inflation continuing to rise. So a lot of people now think that, you know, maybe that's it. Maybe we're past the peak. Now, as it happens, looking at the numbers in my spreadsheets, I think there's actually a chance that inflation may bounce back a bit in September, in the current month, and that's actually partly to do with the Moon Festival and associated, you know, buying of foodstuffs and so on. But the bigger picture does seem to be that inflation should be coming down over the next few months. I would expect it to be at 5% or perhaps below by the end of the year.
So your projections are roughly in line with consensus, which is calling for inflation to come down during the second half of the year, even though you think September might not be on the path of going down in terms of inflation.
That's right. I mean, there's been a bit of a debate over the past 12 months as to what's really been driving inflation in China. On the one hand, there are those who have said it's really just about disruption in certain markets, and in particular recently, of course, pork prices have gone through the roof. But there are others who said that it's a wider phenomenon, that the economy is overheating and all this lending that we've seen over the past couple of years is pushing up inflationary pressures. But when we sort of dig into the numbers, we can see that apart from food, inflation in everything else is still pretty low, and importantly, it's also pretty stable. What we call core inflation, so that's everything except food and energy, is only 2.5% at the moment. So that sort of supports the argument that the spike in inflation we've seen over the past year or so is really because of certain supply shocks in certain markets, and it's not going to last forever. You know, inflation is not going to keep going up and up and up until the policymakers slam on the brakes. So that makes us fairly confident that once these supply shocks have kind of worked their way through the system, and we're already seeing pork prices leveling off, that inflation should start to steadily come down. And I'd expect a lot lower inflation next year, for example, than we're seeing at the moment.
One of the key prices in terms of food prices, pork prices, there is actually a statement made by China's Agriculture and Farming Industry Association's head, and he was talking about how because of pork feed prices haven't been coming down, pork prices will continue to rise until the end of the year and possibly can come down next year.
I don't think there's necessarily a contradiction there, because for inflation to remain high, we need prices to keep on rising. It's not enough for prices simply to remain high. Now, it is possible that lower bonds in from pig farmers, and obviously there's significant limits to how fast production can shift in the short term when you're looking at the pig market. So there is a chance that it's a bit slower and the prices don't come down that fast, but I don't think the prices are going to continue rising at the rates that we've seen over the past few months, over the rest of the year. And if that doesn't happen, if prices just level off, then we can be fairly confident that inflation should start to fall.
August loan expansion in China has been very slow compared to last year. Any other factors you think are driving inflation down during the next few years?
My feeling is that it mainly is to do with these food issues. There was a big increase in food prices at the end of last year. So once that sort of drops out of the comparison, then that on its own will tend to bring down the headline rate of inflation. And I've never really bought into the argument that inflation is because of the rapid rate of loan growth, because if it was, you'd expect it to be showing up across the board, or in a lot more products than we have seen. It's hard to see the channel by which a lot of lending to state-owned companies then pops up in higher prices for pork a few months down the line. If that was happening, you'd expect that prices in a lot more areas would be increasing. Another thing that people say, another argument is, of course, wages have been going up very rapidly over the past year or so. But again, if that was the case, then we'd expect to see rapid increases in particularly labour-intensive sectors. And again, that's not really happening. Things like clothing prices are at 1% or 2% year on year. It's not particularly dramatic. So again, I come back to the view that, that this is a short-lived phenomenon. I mean, that's not to say that over the next few years, kind of taking a longer look at it, that things like the credit growth that we've seen and the rapid increase in wages, that they can't have a negative impact, that they can't start to push up inflation. But I just don't think that explains what we've experienced over the past 12 months.
So with inflation pressure cooling down, do you think China's central bank is going to stay put in terms of their monetary policy?
I think the chances of further tightening are certainly fairly low at the moment, particularly when we see what's going on around the world at the moment. I think there's been a sort of a wholesale loss of confidence in the global outlook over the past 6 weeks. And just over the past week or so, we've seen central banks across the region deciding to keep rates on hold. So a lot of Asian central banks have been raising interest rates recently, but have decided at least to wait and see what happens elsewhere in the world. So I think it's likely that the Chinese policymakers will do much the same, particularly if we're right and inflation starts to come down. And there's a sort of separate question as to whether they'll go further and start to actually stimulate the economy, and that really, I think, hinges on what now happens to the growth, partly outside China, but also, of course, or most importantly, what happens to growth within China. The data that was actually released alongside the inflation data today suggested that China's economy is not that strong at the moment. We've seen sort of fairly weak industrial production numbers, retail spending growth has weakened, and so has investment. So the broader backdrop to all this is that China's economy is certainly not in a particularly bad way compared to what we've seen elsewhere in the world, but it's not enjoying the sort of growth rates that it's been used to over the past few years.
What's your projection for China's growth this year, and what level do you think China's growth has to slow to in order for China's central bank to be really thinking about stimulating the economy?
Well, I'm not sure looking at the GDP numbers on their own necessarily helps. I mean, for what it's worth, we think that this year's GDP growth will average just over 9%, of 9.3% or so. But partly that's because, we're well into the year now, and half of the year is in the bank, if you like. So I think they'll be looking much more at the monthly numbers that are coming in. And in particular, what really matters is the sort of month-on-month growth rates rather than the year-on-year numbers, which everybody focuses on. Because if there is a turning point, such as we saw in the end of 2008, it's going to show up much more quickly in those sorts of numbers, I think. But just coming back to what I was saying earlier, the broader backdrop here is that, for example, retail spending in the last 3 months in real terms, and once we take out the effects of prices, is the weakest it's been since 2004 at the moment. So China's economy is not on its knees, but it's not looking that strong. So I wouldn't be surprised if we saw some loosening of policy over the next few months once it was clear that inflation was coming down.
You were just saying retail sales was the worst since 2004, and this is even worse than during 2009?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the retail sales numbers, there's a lot of questions over them, and one of the questions is how come they were so strong in 2009? One of the answers to that is that a lot of government spending actually gets counted as retail sales. Mm. So we have to remember that that's in there. But it's weaker today than at any point in the last 7 years in real terms, which I think is something which people haven't really picked up on that much. And again, also things like industrial production, not as weak, but it's been slowing, a lot slower now than it was just a few years ago. So, momentum is not as fast as it was. Now, perhaps that's a good thing, perhaps that's natural, because you could argue that the pre-crisis rate of growth in China was always unsustainable. It was always being driven to some degree by this consumer boom that we saw in the US. To some extent in Europe. So some slowdown from that was understandable. The Chinese government, I think, will be fairly happy with a measured slowdown from what we saw before. Really, I think the question is, if the rest of the world starts to slow dramatically over the next few months, whether that will sort of tug China's growth even further down. I think that is a risk, and that if that happens, that we should expect more policy stimulus.
So next few months, very important for China. Mostly we're going to look out to the US and Europe and see how their economies are doing. And if they do go into a double dip recession, what can China do? And we're going to talk about that later. But now let's turn to the next subject, middle income trap. This is a theory regarding how countries going through their economic development might encounter a hurdle on this path to become a developed country. For the benefit of those people who are not very familiar with the term, Mark, can you briefly explain what this term means? What kind of phenomenon does this describe?
Sure. Well, the idea of a middle income trap, it really starts from the observation that there are a lot of countries which have grown out of poverty to a middle income level. And we think of that as about $5,000 to $10,000 per head as being middle income. A lot of countries have grown to that point, and then their growth has slowed dramatically, and the hopes that they would catch up with the developed economies have fallen flat. So, for example, if we look at places like Brazil, Mexico, South Africa, their average income per head has risen by less than 1% each year over the past three decades, which is incredibly weak. Even places like the US and the UK have managed to grow twice as fast as that. So a lot of particularly economists and people at the World Bank and such institutions put a lot of effort into trying to understand, why is this? And the theory that people have put forward is that, when you're very poor, it's relatively easy to grow rapidly because all you need to do is move a lot of workers off farms and into factories where they can be a lot more productive. So for as long as you can keep shifting people off the farms into factories, then your growth will be extremely fast. But when the day comes that you've sort of moved everybody that you can move off the farms, then your growth will depend on getting those people in the factories to be more productive at what they're doing within the factory. And that's a lot harder. It takes a whole new set of skills. You need to improve your technology and so on. It depends to a degree on the quality of your education system. And that's where the theory goes. That's where a lot of countries fall down. They do okay on the first bit, but they struggle when it comes to finding these new sources of growth.
And there are some countries who have successfully avoided this trap, particularly a lot of countries in Asia.
Well, a few countries in Asia. I mean, I personally think this is a key point to make, that if it's a trap, it's not a trap that is necessarily that hard to avoid, because I mean, everybody knows about Taiwan and Korea and Hong Kong and Singapore, but there are actually several countries around the world which have managed to get through that middle income level. The others are places like Portugal, for example. easy to forget that not so long ago Portugal was a very poor country. But what all of these countries tend to have in common is that they are either right next to very advanced nations, or they're on the shipping lanes that lead to those advanced nations. So if you think about what happened in Asia, started out with Japanese growth, and then it spread to Taiwan, Korea, Hong Kong, then it spread to China, Southeast Asia. Now we're seeing places like Vietnam. So there's a natural drift around the region. And simply by being in the right place, these countries have certain advantages because companies can just sort of latch on to the existing networks of suppliers and companies, and also the trading routes that take their goods to markets elsewhere. And countries in Africa and Latin America simply don't have that possibility because these networks don't exist there. So I think that's one reason to be actually relatively optimistic for the likes of China, that it happens to be in the right place, really.
Wow, so your neighbors are important. We're going to take a break, and we're going to talk about, can China avoid the middle-income trap? China right now has GDP per capita of around $4,400. So China is approaching that point when the middle-income trap might be right in front of China. But right now, we're going to take a break, and we'll play a game called Long Short.
Long Short.
Yahoo as an independent company.
Short.
The Arab Spring spreading to China.
Short.
China's 12th five-year plan.
Short. There's a pattern emerging.
The RMB as a reserve currency.
Short.
So you don't think the RMB is going to become a reserve currency?
Not anytime soon. Reserve currencies require there to be a liquid market for your assets. There was an interesting news story in the last few days about Nigeria wanting to put some of its reserves into renminbi, which suggests that at the margin this is happening. But it's a fundamental problem that there simply isn't a big pool of investors in these assets out there for you to sell to at the moment that you need to. So,
how long do you think it's going to take?
Well, it depends what you mean. I don't think the RMB stands a chance of dislodging the dollar, possibly ever, or certainly not in the next, say, 20, 30 years. There's a chance that it could become a reserve currency along the lines of the yen today, which is held by central banks, although not in a big way. But even that, I think, is going to take another 10, 15 years.
Okay, we're going to continue. The rule of law in China.
Well, I'm optimistic, long.
Okay. A double dip in Europe.
Long. Very likely, unfortunately.
A double dip in the US.
Getting longer.
Okay. Innovation in China.
Yeah, I'm fairly optimistic. Earlier, I was short the five-year plan. One of the positive things in the five-year plan, and which I think might make a difference, is the government's commitment to significantly increase R&D spending. So innovation, yes, long.
Apple Inc. post Steve Jobs.
Short, reversion to the mean.
Facebook's prospects in China.
I'm not a Facebook user, but I'll have to say short.
2012 as the end of the world.
Well, I've got the Olympics on my doorstep. which, how I see it, it might be a blessed relief, but perhaps not short.
Okay, great. Thank you, Mark. Welcome back. I'm continuing to talk to Mark Williams, Chief China Economist at Capital Economics. Before we go into the second half of the program, I'd like to remind all our listeners that we still have a listener's lucky draw going on. So if you just simply go to our iTunes page and click a rating for us and leave a comment, you might winning a beautiful tablet computer. You can take it anywhere, play games, watch a movie, do some work. Get this for free by just leaving us a comment on our iTunes page. All right, Mark. So we're just talking about, can China avoid a middle income trap? China's GDP per capita is approaching that point. And you were previously describing how geographically China has an advantage to avoid this trap. Are there anything else in China's favor?
I think there's one other thing in China's favor. As I was saying, the idea is that it becomes difficult to continue growing faster once you've moved all of your workers out of the fields and into factories. In China's case, though, that process has still probably got quite a long way to go. China still has maybe 4 in 10 workers are still involved in agriculture. So there's still a significant shift and a significant gain in productivity to be had by moving those people into manufacturing or into services where their output will tend to be higher. Pull then of sort of, you know, positive things. One, China happens to be in the right place to do quite well. Two, it's not that far along its development path, particularly when we look at the rural population.
Well, Mark, you're just describing how China still has plenty of room to improve productivity by moving workers from agriculture to industrial services sector. But China is also facing departure of the manufacturing, the labor-intensive manufacturing industry, going to cheaper places such as Pakistan or Africa. So can that potential of productivity improvement be actually realized, or it will actually create a labor issue when lots of people cannot find work?
I think it's important to understand why in certain sectors, in certain industries, companies are leaving. I suppose I should say that there's not that much evidence of companies leaving. There is some evidence that the sort of share of global exports in some low-end sectors coming from China, China's share has dropped off a little bit, and some other places it has increased. But what we're really seeing is that Chinese firms have calculated that the conditions are better in other sectors, and that makes perfect sense. You know, this is the normal development process, that you move up as your skills improve. So a lot of factories are moving into sort of more technically difficult areas, even within low-end industries. So within clothing, for example, you know, there's the really basic stuff, but there's also the slightly more complex stuff, and that's increasingly where we're finding Chinese firms, and that's because that's where the margins are a bit higher, so Chinese firms can make more money. So I'm not convinced that there is the shift that we're seeing is because companies are really struggling in China. It's actually because they're finding better niches to be in, and so I think that means that there should still be strong demand for workers, and that's certainly what, you know, the anecdotal evidence says. You often hear stories of worker shortages, of companies finding it hard to hire enough people. So I don't think we should be too worried that you know, we've reached the end of the road for labor-intensive manufacturing quite yet.
You were just describing how China is still not really reaching the point where they need to worry about falling into the trap. But when China do, in however long it takes China, do you think China has a very good chance of keep developing its economy?
Well, here's the problem. All the other countries which have succeeded moving from middle income fairly rapidly up to high income, with the possible exception of Japan, have been very small countries. China is following a very similar path to what we saw in Taiwan, Korea, and these places. But, of course, it is that much bigger. So when it grows, it creates a lot sort of bigger waves around the world. For example, at the moment, China's total exports are equivalent to roughly 10% of global output. And that's what the combined share of Korea, Taiwan, Hong Kong, Singapore was at their peak. And then it leveled off for those countries. And there's no sign yet that China's share of global exports is leveling off. It's keeping on increasing. At the moment, exports are rising sort of 20% year on year. So we're seeing China's export share rise rapidly in a world where growth is fairly depressed. And I think inevitably that's going to create a lot of friction. There's going to be a risk of a sort of a protectionist backlash if we continue like this. There's also a risk to Chinese industry that there simply won't be or is not the demand outside China to absorb the amount that China wants to sell to the world. Obviously, you know, once your exports are so large, increasing them 20% each year becomes increasingly difficult. It becomes increasingly difficult to find willing buyers. So in one sense, China, I think, is reaching the end of the line in its current growth model.
And that leads to overcapacity, right?
Exactly. That is a significant risk, which is not the problem that these other middle-income countries faced, but it's a different and, you know, it's still a very significant problem. This all ties back to the rebalancing debate, which, you know, has been going on for the past few years. And I think, in a sense, the focus on the middle-income trap, which has been getting quite a lot of attention both in China and outside China recently, is perhaps a little bit misplaced. I don't think China's going to suffer the middle-income trap in the same way that, say, Brazil did, but it has significant problems of its own.
Okay, we'll just stop it there on this topic, and we're going to move on to our next topic, which is if the U.S. and Europe fall into a double-dip recession, what can China do? Firstly, let's talk a little bit about your sense of how likely it will happen in the U.S. and Europe.
Well, the U.S. position is probably a little bit better, actually, than the European position. But still, the recent data, particularly the sort of confidence numbers that have been coming out of the U.S., have been very weak. And, of course, we've still got extremely high unemployment. The stimulus program that was put in place 2-3 years ago is sort of running its course. The outlook for growth there is not great. But I must say, it looks a lot better than it does in Europe, where all the troubles that we've seen for their periphery has meant that confidence, as you'd expect there, has taken a huge knock. And these peripheral economies are really struggling at the moment.
And the most direct impact for China is, obviously, these are two huge destinations for China's enormous exports. It will hurt China's exports. But there are things that China could do to stabilize the global markets and also to help the situation in the U.S. and Europe. What do you think are China's options?
Well, immense hopes are always placed on China to save the world. Always been asked by clients and investors, you know, what China can do to save the world. And sadly, I think in practice, not a lot is the most likely answer. Remember that China doesn't buy that much from the U.S. or from most of Europe. So we're starting from a pretty low base. And what happened in 2008, 2009, when China put through this huge stimulus, was that certainly China's imports were a lot higher as a result of that. But mainly that was imports of commodities. You know, they're partly to fuel the investment, partly because Chinese firms and the government were taking advantage of the lower prices to build up their inventories. So none of that really directly helped the U.S. or Europe. And indeed, if we look at what happened to China's total surplus with those countries, if China had been a big support to growth, if that kind of bilateral trading relationship was supporting growth in Europe and the U.S., you'd expect the trade surpluses that China runs with them to have fallen. But in fact, they barely budged during the crisis. They fell between 2007 and 2009 by, in each case, about 0.1% of U.S. and European GDP. Now, there can be some indirect benefit, because if China buys a lot of commodities from Brazil, let's say, puts more money in the hands of Brazilian consumers, well, they do tend to spend in a way that Chinese consumers don't. And so there may have been some indirect knock-on benefit for you know, the U.S. and Europe from that, from Brazilian consumption. Certainly the direct benefit that China brought to the world in 2008-2009, or at least to Europe and the U.S., was quite small. The commodity producers, it's a different story. They did very well, both because China bought their products, but also because I think China engendered a increasing confidence around the world, and that meant that the commodity prices stayed higher than they otherwise would have been, which obviously benefited commodity producers, but bad for commodity users, which includes the U.S. and Europe.
At least what China could do is to maybe have another stimulus program, not to specific benefits of the U.S. and Europe, but sentimentally, it can calm the world markets.
I think so. I think that's one of the major, you know, potential ways in which it could help. you know, things have changed in the past 3 years, so I don't think we're going to see anything like we saw back then. Most obviously, of course, there are a lot of worries about the Chinese debt level now, particularly local government debt and the bad debts which are building up within the banking system. So I think there's also probably a lot less appetite within China for a big stimulus of the sorts we saw before, which will probably be, you know, holding policymakers back from the same sort of scale of stimulus if it came to that. In fact, I would imagine that a future stimulus is more likely to come through direct government spending, fiscal policy, rather than bank lending, which is what we saw last time.
Okay, great. Thank you, Mark, so much for sharing your insights with us today.
You're very welcome.
Thank you for listening to today's podcast. Remember to go to our website and the iTunes page to leave us a comment, and you might have the chance to win a beautiful tablet computer. Thanks so much. See you next week.